You're listening to the Wheel of Time TV podcast with Jay Florence.
All right, guys, welcome back to Randland. Today we're broadcasting from the White Tower, so I hope you enjoy all the comforts that Tarvalen has to offer. I have my keeper, Lauren, here with me, and...
I don't know why I'm waving like people can see me. Hi, everyone!
And visiting from the Black Tower, we have the Mihail.
Hello, hello.
Thank you for hosting us at the Black Tower.
Yeah, it was fun.
I know it's not Tarvalen.
Thankfully. Thankfully, yes.
You know, but it was nice. Remind me, who built the Black Tower? Forsaken, was it?
Moving on.
So I have a bone to pick, Mihail, because apparently when we were at the Black Tower, my keeper got off to no good. My eyes and ears have reported a secret that Lauren, our keeper, is keeping.
Oh, yeah?
Are you going to share my secret?
What's the secret?
I don't know. I said I can't.
Share it. No, I want to share my secret.
Share it. You have to share it.
I pierced my nipples.
Oh, shit. Nice.
So we thought we'd name them.
Yeah. All right, what are we naming them?
Lauren's first suggestion was left Masha and right shin.
Masha and shin.
I'm gonna throw out Bane and Shiad.
Bane and Shiad. Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good one, yeah. Should we, like, pull it on Twitter? What should I name my fierce nipples?
If you were on Twitter, we would totally do that.
Good point. Right, I don't know how it works, really.
Oh,
Colin,
shit.
You have to elect a couple names.
Elect some names? Oh, fuck.
I can't wait for my mother to hear this episode.
Oh, yeah, she does listen.
I mean, not in the episode. We could call it the two Amelins. Two Amelins.
We'll name them Harnan and Vannon.
The two Amelins.
Or Fur and Gun.
Fergun.
Oh, man.
Fergun.
All right, Colin, you're almost out of time. You gotta
no, I said the two Amelins. I said Egwene and
Alida. Oh, the two Amelins.
Yeah.
Oh. So which one's the favorite?
I mean, that's up to
Lauren. I'm left-handed and my heart's on that side, so I guess the left side would have to be Egwene.
Okay, good. The next side is Alida. Okay.
The right's Alida.
So that brings us to today's thematic discussion. We will be discussing the two Amerlins.
Nice segue, Colin.
Not just Lauren's friends, but the actual two Amerlins, Alida and Egwene, the most infamous Amerlins of the Third Age, one might say. So we'll have a bit of a history discussion and debate over those two. But first, I wanted to talk production news. Before we get into Wheel of Time-specific news, I wanted to mention that Rosamund Pike has been listed as an executive producer on a upcoming Netflix series, The Three-Body Problem. If you guys have heard, that's a pretty famous trilogy by Cixin Liu, being developed by D.B. Weiss and David Benioff for Netflix as part of their overall $200 million writing deal.
Right.
So very interesting. Obviously, Rosamund is a producer on The Wheel of Time, but I'm curious if she would also be starring in this or if her role is strictly a producer. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I mean, selfishly, I want to say I hope she's not in it because I would prefer to have all of her, you know, time and talent devoted to The Wheel of Time. But hey, you know, like, it's good to diversify, I suppose. She's on two different networks now, so...
Well, she also just did the other Amazon movie where she was Madame Curie.
Radioactive. I actually just watched that last night.
How was it?
Her performance is amazing.
Nice.
Agreed. I really enjoyed it.
I have been haunted my entire life trying to understand the impossible. This is my fight, and I will win it.
Whenever I look at her, I see Moraine's eyes. Mm-hmm. Like, I just... feel like that's Moraine.
What? I don't know what the three-body problem... I guess I don't know anything about the three-body problem, so I don't know what So if she was to be in it, what even role she would be portraying?
I really don't know. It is really vast in scope. So it's about First Contact and an alien invasion.
I love the movie First Contact with Jodie Foster.
Yes.
What a great film. Love that film.
I actually love that film too. And I was really scared of Jake Busey as a child because he plays a terrorist that blows up the first like contact machine.
He's going to come get you.
Yeah, he's like a religious fanatic. And so Jake Busey and religion really scared me. But it's written by a Chinese author. The original series is written in Chinese. It was translated for English-speaking audiences. So, you know, there's definitely mixed reviews about the fact that D&D will be the showrunners of this. Obviously, they'll have support. But yeah, from the author, he describes it as, "I set out to tell a story that transcends time and the confines of nations, cultures, and races. One that compels us to consider the fate of humankind as a whole. It is a great honor as an author to see this unique sci-fi concept travel and gain fandom across the globe. And I'm excited for new and existing fans all over the world to discover the story on Netflix." It is a kind of a global story, so if she is involved, I couldn't like pinpoint it's
right,
you know.
Right.
It feels Cloud Atlas-y kind of.
It's not a character driven story, so it will be interested how it's adapted for television.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't read it. I know you read the first book, right?
I read the first two.
You read the first two? Okay.
It's very science heavy.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And it's
very
conceptual. It's not. I mean, the first book is told through a primary point of view, but it's not about the people or the characters as much as a typical story. But in other news, jumping back to the Wheel of Time, we had some very exciting, long-awaited casting announcements.
That's true.
Yeah, we got Swan Sanch, the adult version.
Mm-hmm. About time.
Yeah, and we got Min Farshaw.
Yes.
Thank God. I love a good Min, and I think we got a great one, guys.
Absolutely.
Yeah, let's talk about it. So we have Sophie Okonedo playing Swan. What do you guys think? She's British.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, I think I remember Sophie most vividly from the Aeon Flux film. Not a great movie, but but she's great. And I love Aeon Flux, the character, but she's great. And also Hotel Rwanda, like that is actually a fantastic film. So when I saw that she was going to be playing Swan, I was super excited. I think that's a great, great casting.
I know she's also been in The Secret Life of Bees, Hellboy, and The Hollow Crown, which was kind of like a British period piece TV series. And she also starred as Cleopatra opposite Ralph Fiennes.
Okay.
Who's one of my favorite actors.
Love Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah, but it's exciting.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's very exciting.
I also love the similarities between her and the young Swan.
Yes, there's definitely continuity there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I had a lot of trouble once they cast Rosamund Pike trying to imagine the person that would play Swan in relationship to her.
Sure, yeah.
But seeing her, I was like, oh, yeah, this makes sense to me.
Yeah, this is great.
It just kind of clicked.
Yeah.
So jumping over to Min, who obviously there was a lot of speculation over whether Min would be in the series since we were waiting for the casting so long. Rafe did confirm that she would be in it, but everyone still was kind of nervous.
Right.
And then Kay Alexander will portray Min Farshaw, another British actor recognizable from Game of Thrones. You guys might have seen her as Leif, who is like kind of the main child of the forest. She's the one that creates the Night King.
It was you. You made the White Walkers.
We were at war. We were being slaughtered. Our sacred trees cut down. We needed to defend ourselves.
From whom?
From you. From men.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I'd like other things that she's been in. I love Fleabag, both seasons. And then Collateral was also an amazing, amazing show.
Oh, I never saw that. That's cool. I saw that. Yeah, so does she feel like Min to you?
Yeah, I'm super excited about that.
Me too.
And then I saw that that clip of her training, fighting, and it was this is badass.
Yeah, there's so many badass women.
Yeah. Yeah, it was awesome.
Unfortunately, there was some negative sort of criticism over this casting. A lot of it was people saying that she's too old to play Min, which I did find kind of laughable. Yeah, I feel like they were just looking for something.
Yeah, that's grasping at straws.
But I mean, in all honesty, why couldn't Min be older than everyone else? Why couldn't Min be 90's age?
She is
older than everyone else.
But not so much. I don't know, looking at the announcement headshot, I couldn't put an age to her.
No, and there definitely was nothing
age concerning.
Yeah, and it never even crossed my mind until it was that thing came up.
I guess I honestly never think about Min's age comparatively to everyone else.
I think she was closer to Nynaeve's age.
I believe that's true. If not, maybe a little older, but somewhere around Nynaeve's age, yeah.
Yeah, but she's in her 20s. That's what the character is.
Yeah.
And honestly, in Hollywood nowadays, your personal age is not necessarily reflective of a character. Totally. You know, most people play a range.
Yeah.
I saw a meme forever ago, and it was the picture of the men from Greece. And it said, I can't believe my teenage self thought these people were also teenagers or something along those lines. These are clearly men in their late 30s and portraying teenagers.
Yeah, Kaneki.
What were they thinking?
I know. I just assumed Kaneki was left back for 2 decades.
So I did come across a tweet regarding the Kay Alexander casting. And I actually, there were a few of them, as there always are, unfortunately, that are kind of negative. But this one had a different take, and I wanted to kind of share it here. It's actually a thread, but I'll read the entire thread because I think it's pretty good. So this is coming from @Jenny724. Her current handle is Black Lives Matter. And the tweet reads, "But here's the thing. I'm Korean American and I have never had representation of me on mainstream anything. I see white people in my mind too when I read. I can't wait to see anything not white. What would it take for a white person to see an Asian as default? I would read or watch anything with an Asian character. There's a reason why I love Babysitter's Club, because there is Claudia Kishi. Japanese was as close as I could get to until All American Girl, which got canceled so quickly. I hungered for any representation. I was okay if they were always sexualized objects or cold-hearted bitches, because anything was better than nothing. I needed people to have something else to tell at me other than You Love Me Long Time, as their only reference to Asian anything. I've lived a lifetime with white as default. I'm ready for more Crazy Rich Asians to All the Boys I've Loved Before, where Asians are people, not a token plot point." So I wanted to read this tweet because I think she really kind of brought to light the opposite side of the discussion. And I think it takes a lot of courage to put yourself out there and put your life out there and for the purposes of getting people to see a different perspective about a certain thing. And I really liked what she had to say.
Yeah, I saw that one too, and I was glad she said something. In other exciting news. In other exciting news, Kate Fleetwood was confirmed as Leandrin. We had mentioned this before, but it hadn't been officially announced by Amazon. You probably know her as Nancy Birch on Harlots, but she's an amazing English actress. I feel like I do have to take back something I said before, because I think when this was initially leaked, I was a little dubious because Kate Fleetwood is not how I pictured Leandrin based on the book. Because I think Leandrin's described as being kind of like a pretty pouty blonde.
Yeah.
And Kate Fleetwood is much, she projects herself as a strong woman immediately. So it was more reflective of Leandrin's secret personality.
Sure, sure. Know.
But now I've had time to digest it and think about it. I'm really excited for this evolution of Leandrin, and she'll bring a lot to this role.
I mean, her angles just scream evil.
I'm not familiar with the actress, but I'm excited to see her in the role.
Yeah. I mean, you watched Harlots, right, Lauren?
I did, yeah. She was like a dominatrix in Harlots. Spoiler alert.
But she also is she's very motherly to the other women. So she looks out for them, but she's sort of like a tough guy at the same time. So even though she has striking cheekbones, she can play many, you know, facets of like a female personality, I guess. And last but not least, maybe least, Peter Franzen was confirmed as Stepan, who is Corrine's warder. So our predictions from last week were correct.
We're correct, yeah.
Yeah. And then, Colin, do you want to talk about this tweet that you sent me about Azuka Hoyle?
A couple days ago, there were a couple other tweets. This first one coming from at Blau Granada, current handle, Rest in Peace King. So she says, I still think Azuka Hoyle is too bloody gorgeous not to be Lanfear. My theory is that Dana is her alias instead of Celine. And it's, of course, a gorgeous picture of Azuka Hoyle. It looks like she's on kind of a, what is it called? A step and walk? Step and repeat.
Step and repeat.
But yeah, she looks great. She's in this gorgeous, kind of looks kind of like velvety black dress with a nice brooch. Her hair is kind of like, has nice waves, laid in nice waves. And then we got a retweet of this from at of the Brown Aja, Rand Althor's therapist. Wait, I can see her rocking the all-white outfit with the moons in her hair. I really do hope you're right. This will be great, which I agree. And we got another image of Azuka. It looks like it's like a selfie, and she's got like this great red lipstick on. Her hair is like nice and full. Her eyes are just popping out, and she's got this really nice kind of gauzy, lacy dress with a nice kind of band around her neck.
White choker?
Yeah, like a choker. And it's just gorgeous. And I think she would be a great Lanfear. I agree with this.
I agree. And I think one thing that's sort of interesting is we could see her playing Celine and Lanfear, mm-hmm. whereas in the way it's described in the books, I've always imagined them as looking very different.
Right.
And so this would be like an interesting transition because the audience then would be in on it.
Right.
You know, when she comes back as Lanfear.
Right.
And she definitely can embody Celine and Lanfear. So mm-hmm. that is exciting if it is her and not what we previously predicted, which was Dina or Dina, Tom's girlfriend.
It'll be interesting. We'll see.
I definitely would love to see her as Celine Lanfear. Also love the idea of changing the false name of Celine to Dana to throw everyone off the scent.
True. Because it would be possible that she would appear in this season as Dana / Celine, and then we don't get Lanfear until next season.
Mm-hmm. So crazy!
So for today's thematic discussion, we're talking about the two Amaryllins, which of course are Elaida and Egwene. When we kicked off season 2, we talked about exploring the theme of balance. The pattern strives to create balance in all things. So when I look at these two Amaryllins, I see them really as being foils to each other. What's interesting is that both of them came to power, came to the Amaryllin seat through controversial means, not through traditional methods, we would say. And while Elaida is definitely not a fan favorite, I think Egwene has some very devoted fans, but on the other side of the fence, she also evokes a lot of criticism. So we're going to be looking at some of those critiques today, and we're going to be looking at them through the lens of power. So while we might mention, you know, Egwene's early years, really we're going to be looking at them during their reign and what types of leaders they are and sort of examining what it means to hold power and what it means to wield power. The way I wanted to do the discussion was kind of like a loose workshop where like I'll ask questions and we'll just kind of explore these themes and see where it leads.
Yeah.
Let's go.
All right. So let's start off kind of generally. Like, what does it mean to have power?
I think power is responsibility reinforced with influence, right? It's those two things together. I mean, it could be strength as well, but I think it's some confluence of those three things.
Any thoughts, Lauren?
My thought of power is the ability to make change, to make decisions, and have them be followed through. Like, yeah. You can make change and it is accomplished.
Right. So you have, like, the resources and the sphere of influence to accomplish your will.
Hmm.
And so, you know, you could say someone who has power is generally a leader. What do you guys think are qualities that make a strong leader?
Patience.
Patience? Yeah, throw things out, because I want to kind of talk about, like, talk through a criteria. So when we look at these two women, we're kind of keeping these pillars in the back of our mind. Like, what makes a strong leader? Does a leader need to be likable?
Confidence. No, a leader does definitely not. No. I mean, I think actually a leader needs to kind of lean into being unliked.
Really?
Yeah, I think if you worry about whether people like you or not, you probably won't get much accomplished. Mm-hmm. You're going to step on a few toes and you have to be okay with that.
Yeah, I would agree with the second part of that statement, but not the first. I don't know if they should lean into being disliked, but I think that they should, I think that they should shirk, or like they should not be concerned about whether or not they are liked to a certain degree.
Yeah.
I mean, diplomacy has to come into play as well, which I think that becomes a part of it. But I also think that good leaders need to be good listeners. So they need to recognize that they don't know it all. Or at least, like, you know, there is more to know. And they should be open to getting to know that stuff.
I also think good leaders are good at recognizing people's strengths and applying them where they will be most efficient.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah,
delegating. Yeah. That's a very good core quality of a leader.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. I think confidence is important.
Ditto.
Likeability isn't necessarily important, but I think the ability to earn and maintain people's respect is more important, which is sort of how I feel about Egwene, in that, you know, I'm a huge Egwene supporter, and I decided, you know, it's futile to sort of convince people to like her, but if I could get my point of view across and get people to respect her. I think sometimes people conflate the two. So if those are qualities of a good leader, listening, you know, acknowledging that they're responsible for other people and respecting those people enough to listen to their concerns and delegate, what are qualities of a poor or, like, bad leader?
Power hungry.
Yeah, I mean, I think, honestly, one of the core things of a poor leader is not accepting the responsibility of that leadership position, which is not to say that you won't enact the influence and strength that you have or the power that you have, but just that you're not willing to suffer the consequences of, you know, being the one who, if you failed, it's your fault. You know what I mean? Like, you can't blame your minions. Like, you're the leader.
So accountability is important. Accountability,
yes. So lack of accountability.
Lack of accountability would be a poor leader.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, Lauren, you mentioned something that I've heard applied to both Elida and Egwene that I want to examine more, but the idea of being power hungry. I interpret that as, like, wanting power for power's sake, but I do think that it gets confused with ambition.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Is ambition in itself bad? Like, does ambition make you power hungry?
That's like saying, is pride a fault or a virtue?
Yeah, that's true, actually. I mean, I personally, using your definition of power hungry, that being power for power's sake, I don't know if that's ever a good thing, quite frankly, if you don't have any aims. Now, obviously, your aims could tip that further in the wrong direction, or maybe tip it back in a better direction.
I think when it comes to power, you need an objective. Why do you want power? What are you trying to change? Why are you trying to change that?
I think, to get back to your question, I think ambition by itself is actually not a bad thing, but I think you're right, there is a tipping point. You need to have something, or you need to have some checks on the ambition. You need to have something to temper it, or something that you also are keeping close to you that prevents that from tipping too far in the wrong direction, if that makes sense.
Like, you need to be reminded of why you should be humble?
Well, I mean, I think that's why power hungry in and of itself isn't necessarily a good thing, because if you have no goals, then once you get that power, your concept of what is possible can then change. So if you have nothing to hold on to, such as, okay, I want power so that I can, you know, make sure that everyone in the world eats, then you have something to say, okay, this was the reason I did this. Once you get that power, then you can perhaps stay closer to having that, as opposed to, or achieving that goal, as opposed to getting the power and then saying, okay, now what do I want to do? You know, I think it's harder as a human being to make the right decision at that moment.
Once you have power.
Yeah, once you have the power. Perhaps if you already have a concept of something you want to do beforehand, it maybe is easier to do that.
Yeah,
it makes sense. Let's keep that in the back of our minds when we get into our specific discussion of Elida and Egwene. Now moving into discussing Amberlynn. Before we look at Elida and Egwene, I kind of wanted to look at the role of Amberlynn itself and what that means. I have some notes I can definitely, source from the book, but what do you guys think it means to be the Amberlynn seat?
I mean, isn't the technical term like the keeper of the seals? Like you're supposed to be the protector of the seals of the prison of the Dark One?
Watcher of the seals, yep.
Yeah,
Watcher, there's the word.
It's interesting that a lot of the people in Ranland don't really think about what that means.
Right.
It's kind of forgotten unless they've studied the Carathian cycle. They think of it just as an honorific, but yes. So one of the Amberlynn's responsibilities is Watcher of the Seals. Mm-hmm. I think we could argue that expands to preparedness for Tarmin Gaiden. You know, the seals
sure.
in the Dark One's prison go hand in hand with the last battle. Okay, what else?
The leader of the White Tower.
Yeah, you're there to first to unit
to be Aes Sedai.
To be a point of unity for the tower, I would say.
Oh, isn't it in the oath like I'm here to serve you? Like isn't
yes.
when you take your oath as Amaranth I'm here to serve you or something like that?
Yes. So during the ceremony that Amberlynn's raised, she swears to serve the White Tower. Nothing more and nothing less.
Nothing less.
And I think this is important to keep in mind when we examine Elida and Egwene, because I think, this is the Amberlynn's job. It's to look out for the White Tower and the Aes Sedai. And so, the attitudes and policy that they adopt, has to reflect this. So it's important to remember who the Amberlynn serves. It's not the Dragon Reborn, it's not the Nations, it's the White Tower and the Aes Sedai. She's also the authority over the Aes Sedai in that they call her mother, and she calls them daughter or child, which I think is interesting because, we were talking about the White Cloaks in terms of being clergy-esque, but the Aes Sedai are sort of this, what's not paternal, fraternal, what's the sister?
Sororital.
Sororital.
Yeah.
A sororital nice. Order. In that she's this mother figure, almost like the Pope.
I actually was thinking a lot of the popes or just other global leaders in terms of the Amberlynn.
Yeah, so she's the authority over Aes Sedai. She also is responsible for presiding over war. So we know historically, the Aes Sedai looked over the Trolloc Wars, the Aiel War. And then what we're going to talk about today is referred to as the schism, which is
the schism,
the tower,
the split.
Yeah. And obviously the incoming Tarmin Gaiden. So any other Amberlynn responsibilities?
It is kind of her responsibility to be that mother figure to the Aes Sedai, to know all the Aes Sedai and especially the novices. I mean, not the Aes Sedai, but the novices and the accepted and know what they're doing, what they're up to, and to not know them personally, but to be aware of them, right? I feel
it's part of
her job to kind of have those machinations already brewing, right? I mean, I don't think that that's necessarily a written aspect of her job, but I do think it's part of the position.
Yeah, and it's jumping off from that, it's her job to elect the Keeper of the Chronicles mm-hmm. and the Mistress of Novices.
Exactly.
And I think the Mistress of Novices, I mean, that's her delegate for overseeing the novices. And, mm-hmm. She can report back to the Amberlynn, to keep an eye on someone, blah, blah, blah. And then the Keeper of the Chronicles is sort of like the Amberlynn's eyes and ears in that she can relay information and bring her all the relevant reports, etc.
Mm-hmm.
She's the filter.
Yeah, she's like the Veep.
Yeah.
She's the Veep of the White Tower.
Yeah.
I also feel like the Amberlynn also has, I'm thinking more of Swan than Elida or Egwene, pretty diplomatic at times.
Yeah, no, I think that's important for any Amyrlin.
Like, absolutely. a lot of discussions between different kingdoms and lands.
What's funny is that Rand is the Karakarn, right? So he's the chief of chiefs, right? And like, the Amyrlin's kind of like the queen of queens, right? She's kind of like, because even among queens, she still stands higher, right? In a way, like, not that she's ruling those lands, but like, because of her position, she is automatically sitting in a higher position over those other queens. So yeah, it's an interesting kind of relationship there.
Yeah, I think the same as they say, the Amyrlin is of all Ajahs and none. She's also of all nations and none.
Right.
When you're raised Aes Sedai, you're supposed to be of no nation. You're of the White Tower, and that's where your loyalty is. And I think the Amyrlin serves the White Tower and the Aes Sedai, and the role of the White Tower is to remain a superpower and influencing events through all the nations.
Right.
Which is why they're so powerful.
And she's an embodiment of that thing, yeah.
The last note I'll mention before we dive into our two Amyrlins is that she is also the flame of Tar Valon.
Right.
Until there's the actual flame.
But that is where that honorific comes from, is that we're talking about balance, and this is the counter to Balefire.
Right.
It's the healing flame heals the pattern. So that's everything that Amyrlin is meant to embody. Wanted to take a moment to talk about the checks on an Amyrlin's power. So obviously she's not just an authoritarian leader. There's meant to be checks on her power. So what are some of those?
I mean, the sitters are the most
Hall
obvious
of the Tower.
One. Yeah, the Hall of the Tower, yeah. That's the most obvious one, I'd say.
Yeah, so the Hall of the Tower is kind of like the parliament. We have three sitters from each Aja who are elected by the Aja to sit. And there's also very specific protocols to follow. What can be discussed without the Amyrlin, when the Amyrlin has to be informed of a session. But, you know, going back, the Hall of the Tower, their role is to preside over policymaking, which is really significant.
Yeah.
And the Amyrlin can't just, like, decree anything. A lot of proposals need to be voted on. And there's rules around what can pass with the lesser consensus or the greater consensus. One thing I thought was kind of an interesting loophole is that the Amyrlin can dole out penance to any sisters. And I think we see this with Elida, in that even though there's these checks on an Amyrlin's power, she's the mother and she can abuse them and rule by fear, or they can be cowed.
Yeah, she can brutalize them. Yeah, totally.
On the other hand, though, when a new Amyrlin is elected, all people paying penance are, like, forgiven, like your slate's wiped clean, kind of. Like, you get, like, a fresh start.
And there's, like, a month-long celebration.
Yeah.
The last thing I'll mention is that any visitor may demand an audience with the Amyrlin.
That's right.
It doesn't happen often, but I think it is indicative that she's kind of, like, a public servant. Like, the White Tower, it has its own goals, but it is meant to be, you know, a force for good.
That's interesting, because I feel like it reinforces the idea of the Amyrlin as, like, the queen of queens, in so much as the whole point of royalty, what court was just people, like, presenting their, like, boring ass, like, this guy stole my horse, and, like, who the, you know, like, and they have to preside over that stuff and decide, like, what to do. They're basically, like, the judge for the land, right? So it's interesting that anyone in, quote-unquote, Randland can go to the Amyrlin seat and kind of present their case.
Okay, so now we're diving into Elida and Egwene. I thought it would be kind of fun, because we're in an election year.
Oh boy.
To look at this like a political campaign. And you know, the way we typically look at a campaign is we look at the candidates, who they are, and then we look at the, you know, issues of the times that they're going to be dealing with, and, like, what is their policy? What is their stance on each of these issues? So I thought it'd be kind of fun to look at it more analytically than, do I like this person? Do I think this person is good or bad, etc. Sound good?
Yeah, sounds good. Yep. Let's do it.
So before we get into the issues, just like any election, you have your first impressions of who this person is and, you know, how they present themselves. What are their romantic relationships? What are their friendships? What's their leadership style? Let's start with Elida. What's your initial impression of Elida? How does she present herself?
She's older, so I think therefore she has experience. Mm-hmm. She was an advisor to a queen, so she has seen leading very closely for a very long time.
And Andor is, you know, a flourishing nation.
Yep.
For most of the books.
And a queen is only as strong as her advisor, so she was obviously a very good advisor.
She's also of the Red Aja. Mm-hmm.
Not a fan of that.
Yeah, I mean, okay. So yeah, I would say Elida is intelligent. She is stubborn and overbearing. She's cruel.
She's very cruel.
And she's a misandrist. She's prideful.
Yes.
And she's arrogant.
And I think we learn these things early on, even through Eye of the World.
Oh, yes. Thrown in your face right away.
Yeah. In the way she deals with Rans, the way she's talked about in Andor as, you know, you don't want Elida to just throw you in a dungeon.
Right.
And in New Spring, she really abuses Swan and Moraine when they are accepted. And she says she's preparing them for their test. But she gets rebuked,
yeah,
which makes her very resentful and spiteful. Mm-hmm. And she basically, like, tortures Moraine during her test.
She does. But I will say this, though. I am not positive that she actually did that completely out of cruelty.
You really think she was trying to, like, make Moraine the best Moraine could be?
I'm not necessarily speaking for, like, the testing, but I think there is a reason that she was
so hard.
I think it was a tough love type thing, like a really tough love type thing, that she was so hard on Swan and Moraine.
I would agree.
If you remember, like, Swan and Moraine, like, pulled a prank on her the day before her Aes Sedai test, right? Like, so.
Right.
So she could be a little spiteful after that. But I think prior to that, I think that it was kind of a tough love thing. I think that she saw the potential. Everyone saw the potential because they were the first ones to reach her potential, because she was one of the strongest living at the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so she was like, okay, if you're going to have this potential, you're going to live up to it.
I agree with you, but I think it's still indicative of her character in that I think Elida is a narcissist. And
oh, absolutely.
That she believes she's doing the right thing and giving this tough love, but that doesn't mean she isn't cruel and misguided.
No. I'm in no way saying that, like, I'm not trying to say that what she did was right. I'm just saying that was there too.
No, totally. I'm trying to understand, like, why she that way.
Yeah, totally.
And then we mentioned she's red, so we don't really... She obviously doesn't have any relationships with men. She doesn't have any warders. We could say we see later she does have a pillow friend, Meidani. And she finds out that Meidani's a spy, and she still lets her seduce her and kind of toys with her. So I feel like this is another example of her ability to be kind of cruel and unethical.
That's true. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, she also does the same thing to Medaya that she does to Swan and Moraine, right? Mm-hmm. In so much as she is cruel in that way, in a way that, like, we understand. But she also, she broke off that relationship, the pillow friend relationship, after she ascended. And she pushed her in the same way, like, in a cruel way that she did to...
Yeah.
To Moraine and Swan. So I think it's just a reinforcement. There's a complexity to her character. And so much as she's both cruel but also loving, and her only way to show love is by being cruel, maybe? I don't know.
I feel like she rules with fear. Like, she finds more power in striking fear in others, whereas sometimes other people rule, you know, you get more flies with honey sort of thing instead of, you're going to do this because you're fucking terrified of me.
I wouldn't describe Elida as an inspiring leader.
Definitely
no,
not.
No.
In talking about power, I also think that power is a corrosive thing for Elida in that it reveals her materialism. I think one reflection of that is the Amyrlin study. You know, it's described in great detail when Swan is Amyrlin, and it's very transformed when Elida takes control in that there's a lot of gilded
It's much
things.
More opulent, yeah.
Yeah, she has her miniatures.
Yeah.
She is erecting a palace for herself.
Yeah, the palace is a pretty big materialistic boon.
And so I won't go too far down that rabbit hole, but that's, you know, I think sums up initial impressions of who Elida is as a person. Mm-hmm. Oh, I will mention Elida. I think talents and strength are also like a criteria of the Amyrlin. We know that Elida is very strong in the One Power, and she has the talent of foretelling. So that could make her, you know, a good Amyrlin.
Right.
So then we have Egwene by contrast. If we said Elida's mature, then Egwene's quite young.
She's quite young. It's true.
She's very young, but she was also...
She's inexperienced, we could say.
Yes. I would say inexperienced, but she grew up the daughter of... He was the innkeeper. He was also the mayor. So she saw leadership within her family. I'm sure she saw that very closely. So there, she has some kind of example of what leadership looks like, even in a very small scale of the Two Rivers.
Yeah, that's true. She's inquisitive and determined, logical. She's also stubborn, just like Elida. I said stubborn and intelligent, just like Elida. But yeah, I think she's the youngest of five, right? You guys have five sisters.
Yeah.
So I think that, I think that has something to do with it too. Like, she understands like that dynamic of like family and...
She's also very strong in the One Power. And she has the talent of dreaming, which is also useful, even useful in protecting the tower, in relaying news and communication with other Aes Sedai and even the wise ones.
I would also say at an impressionable age, she left her hometown, and then essentially went to the Waste. So she had to adjust and get a very different perspective on different nations very quickly.
Yeah.
And she adjusted well, I'd say, for the most part.
Yeah. We also know she's strong in earth and fire, which is rare for women.
Yep.
In contrast to Elida's materialism, I was thinking how Egwene sort of is never concerned with clothing. Like, she accepts the clothing needed of her station, but she doesn't fuss over them, you know, or delight in them. It's just sort of what she has to do to get the job done. One thing that Robert Jordan describes over and over again when Egwene is set up in the rebel camp is that she has this folding stool and it keeps collapsing. At one point, she even says, you know, maybe a sturdier desk chair could have been found in one of the towns, but coin was tight. This is something that stood out in my mind that separates Egwene from Elida. Because I thought if Elida was in the rebel camp and it was reversed, she would not give a shit. Like, if soldiers went without eating, she would probably still have a gilded...
Bedouin tent.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and Egwene is so unconcerned with this, like, with her comfort. And that is, like, a reflection of her... determination and dedication to the job, which I think makes her a good leader.
Do you think that's something that she acquired, like an attribute to her personality that she acquired after her time in the Waste? Or do you think that's something that was just innate to her?
I think that it's innate to her because she came from humble beginnings.
But her father was the keeper of an inn. So, I mean, even in the town she was in, she kind of had a nicer digs than everyone else. But then there was also probably that constant level of being hospitable.
Right. I think you're right. She did have she had the biggest house in town, right? She had the only one with the tiled roof.
The wine spring in, man.
But at the same time, I wonder if, while it perhaps was innate, like, it was maybe enhanced through her time with the Aiel and kind of not caring for such luxuries. Maybe. I don't know.
We could talk about her romantic relationships. She does take on a warder during her time as Amyrlin. She takes on Gawain.
Gawain.
I will say, even though I detest Gawain, she sees him as a distraction initially, and she's quite hard on him and sends him away.
Which has got to be really hard to do.
It is, and I do think that some people criticize her for the way she treats Gawain.
She's just committed to her role. She doesn't have time for a relationship. I respect that.
Some people view her as disloyal and just high on her own supply, and that her treatment of Gawain is just another example of disloyalty and abuse of her station.
Interesting. I don't know if I agree with that, but two things. I think that to a certain degree, she is heavily influenced by Moraine and what, because Moraine was her first understanding of an Aes Sedai, right? And agreed. Moraine was nothing if not determined. And kind of seeing someone disregard everything else that was not important and focus their whole life on a thing that was not only important to them, but important to the entire world, I think was very influential on Egwene. And again, this is, you know, nature versus nurture type thing, but like, I think that she saw that and kind of took to that model in addition to being herself a determined and driven person, which I think adds to kind of why she treats Gawain that way. You know, she's like, oh no, I have this thing to do. Even though I do care for you, I have stuff to do, you know?
I mean, I feel like her attention to Gawain is, maybe she'd like a better stool, but maybe she'd like to spend time with a man, but it's just like, this isn't important right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's very selfless of her not to take up a relationship with him in the beginning, I think.
In closing, I'll say that I also think she has to be extra hard on Gawain because he doesn't obey her.
Yeah, right?
And I think, you know, she did grow up with the example of Moraine and Lon, and
he doesn't obey her.
Right?
Well, damn. That is, I mean, but her first example of an Aes Sedai in water was Moraine and Lon, and Lon jumps when Moraine gives an order. He doesn't mm-hmm. question it, ever. Like, it takes a really big thing for him to say anything, and the minute she gives him, like, side eye, he shuts up and goes and does it.
That's true. But are you talking about Egwene and Gawain pre-bonding or post-bonding?
Once she takes him on as a warder.
Okay.
So there was also no romantic relationship between Lan and Moraine.
Moraine, yeah.
So she probably never felt like a power struggle between it, like, oh, he must feel like my equal because we're in love.
I mean, I think even beyond just her, I mean, she sees Moraine and Lan, that relationship. She doesn't really see Nynaeve and Lan. Once Lon becomes Nynaeve's warder, they are an example of husband and wife mm-hmm. that are Aes Sedai and warder, and I would say that Lon obeys in the same way to Nynaeve.
Yeah.
Maybe even more so because she's his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he'll say things in private and not in public, and I do think that's like kind of a thing that Gawain struggles with.
Right.
Because he constantly is just like publicly to like disagreeing with the Amarylline Sea, and she's like, dude, like, I'm the fucking Amarylline, like, you know?
Yeah.
But okay, so those are our two candidates. I wanted to move into, you know, so after we sort of have our initial impression of the people who are elected, we look at who their people are, like, who's in their cabinet, who's in Congress. In this case, we have the Hall of Tower, we got the Keeper, we got the Mistress of Novices. It's different in the White Tower and the Rebel Tower. And so what I wanted to look at is the Amarylline's relationship to the Hall of the Tower first. So how would you describe Elida's relationship or treatment of the Hall of the Tower?
Tenuous. At best.
Abrasive.
Right? I mean, like, I think obviously correct me if I'm wrong, but my remembering of her interaction with the Tower is such that she didn't have much power over them because they put her there. Right?
Right.
Like, essentially. So she had to then browbeat them into reminding them that she was in this position, right? She had to convince them, like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, always putting people in dungeons and beating them with, like, whips of air.
Exactly. So she knew that she had no influence over them, so she had to create influence over them.
Yeah. When Egwene is in Teleron Rioed and goes to Elida's study and they look at those scraps of paper in her, like, memo box. She says, every last one of those scraps told of Elida ruling by edict and caprice, with not even the hall daring to stand against her.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what starts as a need to assert her authority in the beginning turns into ruling by fear and sort of bullying.
Mm-hmm.
So she definitely dominates the Hall of the Tower. By contrast, how would you describe Egwene's relationship with the Tower?
Hmm.
I like that she has Suan as counsel.
Secret counsel, yeah.
Secret counsel, right. I mean, that's interesting because it's It depends on what we're talking about. Egwene, when she's in that position, she shows a lot more shrewdness and cleverness because she has to somehow formulate these plans, obviously with the help of Swan, but also play the tower against itself. You know, she's got all these other things that she's trying to do before she can pull the rug up from under them and really kind of show them like she's in charge. So they kind of do, the two characters do similar things by completely different means. It's interesting.
It's also interesting how Egwene was elected mainly as a figurehead, and then she kind of lets them think that she's under their thumb, and then she just so subtly and casually does become the Amyrlin, even though she was not necessarily put in the... She was put there almost as a scapegoat, like a just in case. Like, oh, if this person gets knocked down, like, we could say, like, oh, she was young. And I guess she was pretty diplomatic because she's of no Aja.
Yeah, it is one of the pillars of the Amyrlin to be of all Ajas and none. And I think that Egwene is somebody that truly embodies that, not just because she is not raised Aes Sedai, but because she uses cold logic. She's a diplomat. Maybe she's not a healer, but she is trying to heal the division, the schism in the tower, and unite these women.
I mean, in the end, she was a huge healer, right?
Yeah.
She healed the world.
Yeah.
She's super green Aja because she's a battle badass. She's blue Aja because she's worldly. She's like figuring out ways to bring all these wilders under the umbrella of the White Tower.
And how she brings in the kin.
And she's red. No, she's not really red.
I don't think
she's, I don't know.
She's a little red. I think that men are like, she's not anti-men, but she's probably as skeptical of men. I think that in her relationship to Rand, Matt, and Perrin, you might see a little bit of red. One of the criticisms of her is people think of her as, you know, sexist. They think that she's unfair in that she doesn't consider that Matt, Perrin, and Rand might have experienced the same sort of character growth as she has, but she doesn't treat them with like the same respect. She's a little skeptical. I don't think it's a huge criticism of her in my book, but like I could see a little bit of red Aja in that way. But yeah, I think she tries to use the skills of every Aja through her leadership.
Yeah.
It's almost part of the Amyrlin's job to figure out ways to, you could say, I would say persuade, but it takes clever sort of calculated manipulation of the tower to get them on your side. And, and that's like every Amyrlin's burden.
Well, I think it's also interesting because Elida completely flouts tower law and kind of like, in order to get things done, as you just kind of...
She was almost going to make a new oath, wasn't she? She was going to make a fourth oath.
Yeah, exactly. She was going to make a fourth oath. But as you were saying, like, when they kind of go through her papers and it shows that she's doing all these things without Tower's kind of consent, or at least backing, whereas Egwene, she solidifies her power by using Tower law.
Yep. It's very Ruth Bader Ginsburg of her.
And by using Tower law, she convinces the Tower that she is clever enough and smart enough and powerful enough to be the leader, right? So she does two in one. She does it, she says, I am the leader, and you have to obey me because of this law, but she also convinces them that she should be obeyed because she did the thing.
I wanted to talk about two corrosive forces that both Elida and Egwene have to grapple with that have a negative impact on their rule, and I think are a catalyst for some of the criticism for both of their leadership. For Elida, it is Padan Fane and the dagger. So we do see this take its toll on her, and I think she becomes more hostile and vapid and sort of unstable in her rule. Like she comes from being like a pretty powerful woman to letting Alviarin get the upper hand with her pretty quickly, and she starts to like have one blunder after the other, and I think some of it can be attributed to the dagger and Fane and that shadow. And in Egwene's case, it is Halima, who is really Bathamel, who is causing these chronic migraines and headaches. And I think that maybe Halima just doesn't do as much damage as like the dagger, which is, you know, one of the worst things in Randland. But it does, I think, make Egwene more snippy and she becomes more irritable. It's kind of amazing that in spite of that, like it doesn't really corrupt her judgment. So I wanted to read one passage from Egwene's POV during her time in the rebel camp. Ruling by edict had its disadvantages. When people had to obey you in one thing, they always found ways to wriggle away on others. And the more they were forced to obey, the more places they found for wriggling away. It was a natural balance you could not escape. Worse, she had learned just how addictive it was to have people jump when she spoke. You came to take it as the natural way of things, and then when they failed to jump, you were caught on the wrong foot. Besides, with her head pounding, it was pounding, now, not throbbing, though perhaps not as sharply, with her head. She was ready to snap at anyone who looked at her crosswise, and even when people had to swallow it, that never went down well. So she remains very self-aware, even through the pain.
I think that's a really good point, but I also think that Egwene has, in the same way that Rand does, not the same way, but in a similar way, she has unrecognized trauma, mm-hmm. right? And I think that does affect her negatively. Yes. Like her time spent with the Shanshan.
Oh, yeah.
It forces her to become blind to anything that has to do with them. Do you know what I mean? Like yes. Later, she's as soon as you say Shanshan, she shuts down. Which, like, fair enough, but also, like, you can't do that. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
As we talked about, like, listening is part of being a good leader. So I think that's another thing that Egwene's character is dealing with that, like you said, it doesn't stop her from getting the job done, but it is another layer that's inflicted upon her as opposed to something that's natural to her, you know?
Well, let's talk about the Shanshan since you brought it up, because I would say that grappling with the Shanshan is one of the relevant issues of the time.
Yeah.
So we could look at both Elida and Egwene's policies on them. One of the things influencing Egwene later, when she's captive in the White Tower, is that she has a dream that she shares with Elida and says, I had a dream. I know it to be a true dream. I interpreted it that the Shanshan are going to attack the White Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And Elida does not take it seriously at all.
Right.
But I think Egwene is not wrong to see the Shanshan as a threat. I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that they can't be, like, negotiated with at this point, even though she's biased with her trauma.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that, especially in that moment, Egwene is much more open
mm-hmm.
to just the idea of, like, acknowledging that the Shanshan exist than yeah. Elida is, right? Like, Elida's just too focused on her own shit to, like, care about anything else. And also, I don't think Elida at that point has actually had any contact with the Shanshan, right. Unlike a lot of the other characters in the story at that point.
Yeah, they're kind of out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
But I do think, like, if it was Swan in that role and someone brought her, like, said, I had a dream, I had a true dream.
Absolutely.
She would prepare, even if she thought it was unlikely. I think yes. A good Amyrlin would be like, okay, what do we do in event of an attack? There's a lot of crazy shit going on in the world. Like,
right.
How do we make circles? Like, let's practice a little.
Right, right, yeah.
And, yeah, Elida's like, not my problem.
Well, that's interesting because it's talent versus talent, right? Talent being Egwene's dreaming, which is what was invoked here, versus Elida's foretelling, which she often does, right?
Yes.
Not often, but she does.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that Elida is, she obviously, like, believes in her own talent, but she's refusing to believe in someone else's at this critical moment. That becomes her downfall, really.
I mean, Elida is unwilling to accept other people's power is greater than hers because mm-hmm. she's been all powerful for so long and then all of a sudden she's not really. I mean, she's right. Still good, but she's not great.
Yeah. Let's talk about another issue of the time, the Dragon Reborn. How would you describe Elida's views and policy on dealing with the Dragon Reborn?
My remembrance is that she just wants to, like, lock him up until Tarmogoyen, right?
Yes!
Yeah. She just wants to lock him in the White yeah, Tower and call it a day. She just wants to
lock him up, like, and then release him like a fucking dog, you know? Like, here you go.
Which she very literally attempts to do.
Yeah.
Which results in Dumai's wealth.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a huge blunder that she also tries to cover up.
Yeah, exactly.
It's secret. It's done without, you know, knowledge of the hall.
Right? Yeah, it's like covert ops in the hall, for sure.
And I would say, like, the Black Tower and Ashaman are an extension of, you know, dealing with the Dragon Reborn. Mm-hmm. And she also sends, I think, like, 50 sisters to deal with them. Because without any investigation, ignoring reports from eyes and ears that they had grown. And she basically just throws away the lives of those sisters, you know?
Yeah.
By sending them to the Black Tower.
Ugh.
By contrast, how do you think Egwene deals with Rand?
Well, she has history there, so there's obviously that.
Some people say she does a bad job of dealing with Rand.
Because of the history they've had?
Yeah, I actually kind of agree. I don't think her dealings with Rand, especially once they come into their own as the people they were meant to become, is really all that great, quite frankly.
Right.
And I think that that kind of... I think that ties into the point you made earlier about her not recognizing the growth in the other people, and especially the boys. She kind of, I feel like her dealings with Rand are more like, no, I'm right. We need to do this thing. What you're doing is wrong and crazy, and you might be crazy. You know what I mean? Like, she's not really fair, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's just not a focus for her.
Yeah.
Like, Rand comes to her later.
Yeah.
But I mean, not that she doesn't have a full plate. She definitely has a full plate. I think Absolutely. By the time she's like, okay, I got it. Her whole energy is focused on uniting the tower. Mm-hmm. And then Rand is the catalyst for her uniting the nations.
Yep.
And so, I mean, it works. I think that this is off topic, but I think the biggest criticism of her character comes from this idea of disloyalty. And that she's become so power hungry that she just doesn't care about the people she grew up with. So I do want to look at that for a second, but I would argue that she's very loyal to the women that she's serving with in the White Tower, like Lyanna and Swan. I think she is a very loyal person, but I think she is typical of Aes Sedai, and their point of view is Aes Sedai first, and Aes Sedai are superior. I think one scene I wanted to bring up, which is a crux for a lot of people, is when Egwene catches Nynaeve in Teleron Rioed, and she frightens Nynaeve by triggering a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
Egwene does not make this nightmare. It's from Nynaeve's mind. She just, like, lets it loose, and mm-hmm. it's like, you know, I forget if it's Trollocs, but it's some, like, gross, disgusting guys, and they, like, rip her dress and grab her and, like, grab her face, and people freak out about this, and they're like, Egwene is immoral, disloyal, like, disgusting, drunk on power because she did this, and the trauma of it, like, you can't erase that. I will say this for Egwene. It's definitely condemnable that she would be so reckless as to release this nightmare. She does not know what kind of threat it would release to her friend. She doesn't know if it's going to be scary monsters or what we see, which is the threat of assault, which is unacceptable and something you should never do to a friend, especially someone who mentored you, who you grew up with. And so it's really understandable that fans would dislike Egwene for this reason. Also, in retrospect, upon rereading, I had forgotten that she's not just doing this because she's concerned about Nynaeve's own recklessness in Teleron Rioed, but she's actually deflecting from the fact that the Wise Ones haven't permitted Egwene herself to be running around Tar. So this is an issue. I would like to believe that while Egwene is doing this, she does believe that she's trying to help Nynaeve and she's trying to scare her into being cautious.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's one of those things where it's twofold. It's two things at the same time. I would assume that everyone can remember to a time when they did something that they weren't necessarily proud of, but they also felt like they needed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's one of those moments where Egwene was like, maybe, you know, I can't say she was completely had Nynaeve's best interest at heart in that moment, and she wasn't a little spiteful or being cruel. But I think it's both. And I think people contain multitudes, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that is also part of what makes these characters human, is that they do shitty stuff. They make mistakes, you know?
Yeah, she is flawed. She's not perfect.
Yeah, totally.
I also think maybe she was pushing Nynaeve, and she has a personal relationship with Nynaeve, so she knows what she can handle.
Yeah. I think it's tricky. Like, she's learning to be separate from the people she grew up with. She has That's to be true. Because she's Amyrlin, and it's not always going to be pretty. And I think some people start to really dislike Egwene because she, you know, she has to be a different person. She can't play favorites. And I think they expect her to play favorites and be more, like, personable. But I do think that the job is taking its toll on her and starts to transform her. But I don't think she's necessarily drunk on power or enjoys being cruel. Yeah. She does make mistakes. But I think she realizes she's alone. No one else can be Amyrlin or help her with this burden. And it does separate her from her friends. She's not in the fold. Like, Avienda and Min are more in the fold than Egwene is.
Right. I think, like, and this is interesting because I was thinking about kind of the relationship between the women as they grow throughout those few years, especially through the meetings in Teleron Riad. And kind of when we're seeing them in probably maybe books 4 and 5, there's a testing that occurs between the ladies, especially between Egwene versus Nynaeve and Elaine. They're thinking about the days before they're going to have these meetings. They're thinking about the last meeting and not just the information that they need to exchange, but the power dynamic between those two quote-unquote factions, right? Egwene versus Nynaeve and Elaine, or sometimes usually Egwene versus Nynaeve.
Yeah.
And how they're going to come to this particular meeting, not only to disseminate information, but to one-up the one before, oftentimes. And in some ways, Egwene is testing the boundaries of her autonomy because Nynaeve is, in some ways, a mother figure, right? Nynaeve kind of carries that with her, but also Egwene sees that, at least a mentor, if not a mother figure, right? So it's interesting to see Egwene kind of pushing against that relationship. And we can see that where that works. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, right? And we can see both sides of it. We can see how it looks from Nynaeve's side when they're in that situation, then how Egwene feels about it afterwards, right?
Yeah.
But we also see the change once Egwene becomes the Amyrlin seat. We see that shift. And I wanted to read a passage from Winter's Heart where we can see kind of that shift. So this is chapter 10 of Winter's Heart. And we're with Elaine and Nynaeve and Egwene. And they're actually in Teleron Riad. And they're talking about the swearing of the three oaths that Egwene has decreed that all Aes Sedai have to do, all women, including the kin. And so Egwene says, "The very first day we have the tower, I will swear the three oaths on the oath rod." "That's madness," Nynaeve burst out, leaning forward in her chair. Surprisingly, still the same chair and still the same dress. Very surprising. Her hands were fists resting on her lap. "You know what it does. The kin are proof. How many Aes Sedai live past 300 or reach it? And don't tell me I shouldn't talk about age. That's a ridiculous custom, and you know it, Egwene." Rhiann was called eldest because she was the oldest kinswoman in Ibodar. The oldest anywhere is a woman called Aloysia Nemozny, an oil merchant in Tyr. Egwene, she's nearly 600 years old. When the hall hears that, I'll wager they'll be ready to put the oath rod on a shelf. "The light only knows 300 years is a long time," Elaine put in, "but I can't say I'm happy myself at the prospect of perhaps cutting my life in half, Egwene. And what of the oath rod and your promise to the kin? Rhiann wants to be Aes Sedai, but what happens when she swears? What about Aloysia? Will she fall over dead? You can't ask them to swear not knowing." "I don't ask anything." Egwene's face was still smooth, but her back had straightened, and her voice cooled and hardened. Her eyes augured deep. "Any woman who wants to be a sister will swear. And anyone who refuses and still calls herself Aes Sedai will feel the full weight of Tower Justice." Elaine swallowed hard under the steady gaze. Nynaeve's face paled. There was no mistaking Egwene's meaning. They were not hearing a friend now, but the Amyrlin seat. And the Amyrlin seat had no friends when it came time to pronounce judgment. Apparently satisfied with what she saw in them, Egwene relaxed. And I think in this moment we see that shift of power. And we see Egwene in that seat and grappling with both sides of it. She's fully taken on the idea of, like, okay, I have this responsibility and I can't be their friend right now. I have to be the mother. I have to be Amyrlin's seat. But also trying to hold on to at least vestiges of that personal relationship too.
I'm really glad you chose that passage. I think the question of the kin and the Othrod and the Threos is really important and reveals a lot about Egwene's character. But like you said, this scene reveals the shifting power dynamics and her relationship to them. And I think it's interesting as time goes on and Elaine and Avienda come into their own as well, they start to act differently.
Mm-hmm.
Elaine has to represent her interest to Andor as well as to the White Tower. And she's a pretty deft politician herself.
Yeah.
So she's navigating and not treating Egwene as a friend when she's calculating how she's going to use the kin for Andor.
Right.
You know, and there's a later meeting with Avienda and Egwene. And obviously, I think that Egwene has a special friendship with Avienda from her time training in the Aiel. But Egwene starts to recognize Avienda's shift and acknowledges, oh, she's acting as a wise one now. She's talking as a wise one, not as my friend. But I feel like Egwene's the only one who gets flack for it. And it's like no wonder she has to make her point very clear, because they are her friends and sometimes they have the most trouble respecting our authority. And, you know, Egwene has a job to do.
Yeah.
That brings me to another election topic, how to deal with wilders, which I think you just brought up by mentioning the kin.
Yeah.
So this is something that Egwene has the most knowledge of. Elida's not even really thinking about it, but I would say Elida's attitude towards wilders is pretty negative.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah, and also characterized by ignorance.
Yeah.
But Egwene has to grapple with the fact that there are a lot of channelers among the sea folk, the Aiel, and the kin.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she tries to respect all those cultures. She still obviously has her own aims for the White Tower, but I don't think they're like insidious. I feel like Elida, had she had knowledge of them, would be like, hunt them down.
Right.
Lock them up until the last battle.
Leash them.
Yeah, Elida would have, basically she would have said like, okay, we'll go get them and bring them to the tower. Like, capture those women who can channel. She would have been, in some ways, no better than the Shanshan, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to Egwene, who, yeah, I think she tries to find, she basically promises the wise woman, like, we're not going to pillage, you know, your lands for channelers. But I think she tries to do that, even if she doesn't have that conversation with each culture, she tries to do that for each culture.
Well, wasn't there going to, there was going to be like the exchange of...
Yeah. Student exchange program.
Yeah, the student exchange program between right. the sea folk, the Aiel, and the White Tower.
Yeah.
Yeah, she sees merit in what they have to offer. And so I think by creating an exchange program versus saying you have to send us this quota to the White Tower, like, she sees the benefit and knows that this is the future. And she yeah. does add, I forget if it was her or if someone else prompts that if someone wants to stay and
yes.
see out right. their training with one of the, quote, right. wilder groups, then they will be allowed to do so. And she says yes, and vice versa is true for the White Tower.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a good point, because it obviously is very different from Elida, because she recognizes that, especially after a time in the Waste, she recognizes that the White Tower isn't the only way or the yep. best way. It is just her way. And so in doing that, she respects those other cultures. And I think that really is the way forward.
Yeah, go Egwene.
Uniting nations.
And then I think we can talk about the last battle, and then I want to end with just talking about the unification of the tower. But in terms of the last battle, obviously Elida is not a player at that point, and Egwene is in power. But Egwene really shows her green Aja leanings, I think, in Tarmon Gaiden on the field of Marilor, and obviously she wields the flame of Tar Valon. A lot of people are just like, yeah, she sucks, and then they just give her this awesome plot line at the end. But I don't think that's true. I think she's a real fighter.
Yeah.
You know, and I think she takes all that trauma, anger, and just like is finally able to unleash it against
yeah.
pure shadow.
Light up the world. Heal the world. Yeah. Another very selfless act.
Okay, so last but not least, obviously during the schism, I want to talk about the way Elida deals with it versus the way Egwene deals with it. Anyone want to take a stab at Elida's actions?
I mean, she's pretty shitty because she absolutely, I mean, she gets rid of the blue Aja altogether. Like, changes the colors on her stole and everything, which is pretty shitty just to throw one out. They're just so opposite, and, like, Egwene is trying to, like, oh, let's see what we can do. Like, let's find more. I haven't got a lot to work with, but I'm going to work with what I have. And, like, Elida's basically given everything to work with, kind of, and kind of, like, takes her power and then just, like, shits all over it.
Yeah.
She does. She just squanders all of her power.
Yeah, I mean, I think her pride, for like, causes her to squander her power, for sure. But I also think that, like, I mean, like, she had that meeting with Cat Swain, who told her that she was too rigid. And I think that's basically what happens, is she makes a decree, like, everyone come back to the tower and kneel to me, basically, is, like, how she deals with the schism. Like, she basically says, you're a traitor or you're under me, as opposed to Egwene, who, first of all, we've already commented on the fact that she comes into her power by way of tower law. She uses the law to her advantage. But she also does attempt to siege the tower, and she gets captured. But I think that once she comes into her power, the way that she's able to heal the tower is indicative of a greater ability to lead, or at least a better ability to lead.
Yeah, I mean, I think when Egwene is raised too, someone does mention to her, like, should we drop the red stripe? Because there's no one from the Red Aja in the rebel camp. Mm-hmm. And Egwene insists on wearing the seven stripe stole, which is an obvious contrast to Elida, who removes the blue, which, I mean, how do you repair that? It's shutting the door on being able to
unite the tower and the schism.
Yeah. And she says her plan was, like, to punish them and make them re-swear and then choose a new Aja from, like, six colors, which is, like, crazy.
It's wild, yeah.
But I did want to mention, you know, so while Egwene does have the tower under siege, she's pressured by Aes Sedai and by Gareth Bryn to assault the tower. Because at this point, they can make gateways, and Elida doesn't necessarily have that knowledge. And, you know, Egwene puts her foot down and won't do it. At one point, Anaya says, after all, however much we want to avoid sisters killing sisters, it wouldn't be the first time. The tower has lasted a long time and healed from many wounds. We can heal from this one, too. And Egwene's like, no fucking way.
Yeah, she's like, what the hell?
Yeah, and she's getting pressured from all sides, so I think it is a sign of her strength and vision for a whole tower that she is biding time to find another way.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, I guess how she uses her capture to her advantage. But yeah, I think that puts her in stark contrast with Elida. I'll say, just in closing my thoughts, Egwene is a strong leader because she always thinks of herself as a student. And I think that keeps her humble. Like, she's a good listener, but she says, or it's from her POV, but it says, she had oceans to learn about being Amyrlin, oceans to learn and a job to do. And I feel like that sums up Egwene. Like, you know, she's smart. Yeah. She's always listening. She's trying to do her best for everyone in her role, but she does recognize she doesn't know everything, but she still has to act decisively. You know, it's hard times, to say the least.
Overall, I like Egwene. I can't actually say she's one of my favorite characters, but I do like her and respect her. I think that she has a really great arc. I think she's, like, obviously one of the great characters of the series. But I like this conversation. I like kind of digging into both of them and looking at those contrasts, their different styles.
I also really liked this topic a lot because they are so different and it's so easy to compare and contrast them. And I love Egwene as a character. Well, on top of what Colin said, she does have just a phenomenal storyline. I don't think she has a shitty storyline at all, and then she, like, blows up at the end. I think she has a really great arc.
Yeah.
And growth.
Yeah. And for Elida, any redemption for Elida?
I mean, I guess you could say you know, there's no redemption. I don't think she deserved to be leashed. I will say that. I don't think anyone deserves to be leashed, but no, she's terrible beforehand, even after she's tainted by Fane, so.
Colin?
No, Elia doesn't really deserve, there's nothing to redeem.
No.
I mean, I will say that I think she's interesting because she's not a dark friend.
Mm-hmm. She is just her own evil.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things, I think, about her character, that she is 100% an antagonist, but in her own right, as just being a human, which is great.
I feel like you could look at them just as a sort of analog, as like Elida and Cersei and Egwene and Daenerys, because the way people who dislike Egwene is so much like season 8 Daenerys, like just like high on her own supply. But it's going to be interesting how views change with the television series based on who portrays these characters. I wouldn't say that Cersei is like a likable character, but the way Lena Headey brought her to life, I mean, I just fucking loved watching Cersei, and I did have so much respect for her, even though she's not evil, but she does have a lot of the same flaws as Elida has, and the same cruel streak. So it'll just be interesting how attitudes and favorites might change with the TV series.
That's so true.
And I think that if some people say that Egwene has like an inconsistent arc or like annoying parts of her arc, that might change also with the writing of the television show.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see just how much they keep in that arc.
Well, thank you guys so much for talking about this. We'll close out with a quick Twitter of Time highlight from @RoadToTarValen, handle @AlwaysTheNovice. While we're talking about inclusivity, do you think at Wheel of Time on Prime could incorporate sign language into Maiden Talk, or do you see it as something entirely different?
I would see it. I think it would be much more subtle and casual. There's so much movement to it, whereas I feel like Maiden Hand Talk is a little more casual, like it's a little more nonverbal.
Like smaller, like more discreet, like smaller.
Yeah, I think it would be a lot more subtle than, because I feel like when people speak in sign language, there's a lot of gusto involved. Mm-hmm. Whereas I don't get that with Maiden Hand Talk at all.
I mean, I think that the Aiel, they're described as being less emotive in general than, you know, kind of wetlanders, which would be like us, I suppose.
Like they'd rather text than talk.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean that they don't have emotions. It just means that they don't necessarily display them as easily or as quickly. I personally don't necessarily see Maiden Hand Talk as sign language, but they could incorporate it. I don't know. I mean, I think that they should keep it separate, just not to blur those lines. So that would be the best way to go. But I would be curious to see how they handle that.
Yeah, there's also different types of sign language, you know,
yes.
There's not just American Sign Language, right. So I would think that they would come up with their own thing.
Yeah.
Also, because the Shanchan, you know, between Tuan and Solusia, Tuan's always like waggling her fingers, and they have their own sort of secret communication that is a form of hand talk.
And Chafail.
Did you say Chafail?
Yeah, they have like their own, like, they like created their own like thing.
I hope theirs looks stupid and everyone else
is cool. I mean, yes,
cool.
But I'm not saying, I didn't say it looked good. I just said they had it.
I hope theirs is like full, like miming, like when you, not Pictionary, but when it like charades. Yeah, just. Thank you everyone for listening. You can learn more about us at ranlandtv.com. and follow us on social. I change my love.